And welcome to the Pocket Gamer Podcast. It's been a while, and my name is still James Gilmore, episode 447. Joining me for the first podcast in 2 weeks, technically, is Rick Cowley.
Hello.
And Emily Soden.
How do?
You haven't all scampered off since I've been away. I'm glad to see. Thanks for sticking around.
Well, Rick technically did.
So just to explain, we mentioned before we went off, but there was going to be a bit of a hiatus because A, I went off for a week to go and do me honeymoon, which was nice. It was good. We're still married. So, you know.
Always a good sign.
9 out of 10. And then I came back and immediately went to Vienna, and Rick buggered off to, was it Mallorca you went to?
Yep.
For holiday funsies. So we've all been anywhere but near a microphone for the past fortnight. Despite trying to persuade Em to do the one-woman show, where she rocks the ones and twos.
there's no time period or dimension in which that will ever be a good idea.
I disagree, but you know, I'm not going to force you to do anything you don't want to do. So it's taken till now for us to regroup, but we're back. Thank you for your patience. We've got a bumper show this week that'll probably be a bit longer because we've got to catch up on some stuff, haven't we? You've been here the most, Em. Did it all go down in the past fortnight? Did I miss the most exciting moment of mobile gaming history, or was it just fine?
Would you like the truth, or would you like me to ease you into it?
Was it what? Terrible things happen?
Nah, it's all just average, you know, the average stuff. Some news came out, people did things, and games came unto the world.
Oh, wow. I like it when it's done in biblical style. And lo, the games came unto the world, and we saw
them.
And it
was good.
And they were free to play. Well, I found some stuff we can talk about, luckily. No shortage of goodies. We're going to bring the Fortnite lawsuit saga to its conclusion this week, finally, along with some hinty news about when it might be appearing on Android for you lucky people. The Harry Potter Hogwarts Mystery Game has got a limited time event, which I don't think you should play because it's a bad game. But I'm going to mention it anyway, along with the App Store turned 10 while we were away, which prompts us to look back on the glory days, the best games, the worst games, and all the marvellous stuff that the last 10 years have brought us in terms of mobile gaming. Plus, we've got a whole bunch of new releases, including the likes of New Star Soccer Manager, sequel to the BAFTA award-winning New Star Soccer. We've got a Walking Dead AR game. We've got Earth Atlantis, a gorgeous shoot-em-up slash Metroidvania thing. Fighting Fantasy Legends Portal has come out. I've played loads of it. We've got Fracture. We've got Battle Art 2. Loads of stuff coming your way. Plus, an interview that I did over in Vienna with Team 17, one of the guys at the production company there, about once you've made your game, how do you get producers interested, and what does it involve getting your game from your bedroom to the world? But first, it's the news. It looks like the score has been settled between the creators of Fortnite and the creators of PUBG in a lawsuit that, if you follow the podcast closely, has been running for months now, stopping and starting and dying and reviving, and now it looks like finally it's been put to rest. According to Bloomberg, this is a new story that you found, M, PUBG Corp contacted Epic Games this Monday and announced their withdrawal. And the case has hence been dismissed and closed.
Hooray!
Yeah, I know, it's good, isn't it? Because this is all a bit daft, and we thought it was daft going along. Like, you're the same company at this point. You're like, they're so intertwined. It's ridiculous. It's like, we've got Tencent, which has got shares in Epic and helps publish the PUBG and the Fortnite, and Fortnite uses the Epic engine, and so does PUBG. Runs off Unreal as well, and like, it's all very convoluted, and I don't know who was trying to prove what, but it's all stopped now, so we can stop caring. Not that I ever really did. But you pointed out something, Em, in the form of this PUBG Core update, which was like, it's almost now like they're going the other way a little bit.
Oh yeah, like, this whole thing is just crazy.
PUBG was the one that was, like, accusing Fortnite of copying it. And now, in the most recent update, PUBG has brought about the Royal Pass emotes, character profiles, and other stuff that look disturbingly similar to stuff that Fortnite has been doing.
Yeah.
I guess one in your eye and then one in my eye, and now everyone's blind.
Yeah, well, and then that goddamn Android news came out earlier this week, which, you know, Tencent potentially might be publishing the game on Android.
Yeah, that'd be cool, right? Because Tencent sent out a tweet saying, Fortnite, space, or sorry, line break, wow, exclamation point, line break, it's coming. And that was Monday, I think it was, wasn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. So it looks like Tencent are going to be publishing Fortnite on Android, and if it's coming, I mean, I guess it's published near the beginning of this month, maybe the end of the month, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, it would make sense to publish it sometime this summer. Realistically, I don't think it's going to come out all at once. Mm-hmm. I think they'll probably do a beta period, same as they did with iOS, because Android is much more difficult to port over.
Hmm.
But also, we're still not sure whether that's actually just for Android, because it's Tencent's like Steam program
over there. Yeah.
Yeah, so that could also be for PC, but I'm not really sure how it works in China.
Got their own platform. Well, what they say is, I think China, we're thinking, gets it on July 24th on Android. We don't know whether it's going to be global. And that's not 100%, but it's, you know, coming soon. So hold your horses, Android folks. You'll be Fortniting before you know it. And it means you'll be able to get your hands on Season 5, which just went live on iOS and on Switch as well. You said this is big, right, Em?
Yeah, it's like, when I downloaded it the other day, it was 1.82 gigs on my mobile. Okay.
Oh, wow.
I know. And a lot, like, because usually some stuff that is in the PC version doesn't carry over to mobile. Mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff is in mobile, as in, you know, there's new places on the map, there's new environments, there's, like, new, like, golf buggy things you can drive around, new weapons, and... Oh, also, actually, in mobile, they've added auto fire.
Ooh. Oh, really?
Yeah, I know. So, like, I mean, obviously, some people might see that as being, like, a bit of a pussy's way out. But if you're thrown into some, like, crossplay games, I mean, mobile doesn't have a chance.
The solution is just to always be firing all of the time and hope for the best. To clarify, auto-fire means that the weapon starts firing when an enemy is within range.
Yeah.
So it's not just always going, and just, you know, sending up a flare as to where you are on the map. You also lose a few things, right? Is that right? So when you get these updates, you lose some areas of the map and gain new ones.
Yeah, like this time, Moisty Myers is gone and Fatal Fields, which I think has been replaced with the new desert area of the map, whatever it's called. Hang on, let me have a look.
Oh, I'm going to say that I'm not sad to lose a place called Moisty Mire.
Oh, you got to love yourself a bit of Moisty. No, it's, which ironically, you know, going from a place called Moisty Myers into Paradise Palms... which ironically is the driest.
All sexual innuendos. Spent a couple of hours at Paradise Palms last night. Whoa, let me tell you.
Oh, I was in paradise. But yeah, so you got that, and then Lazy Lynx is the other one up the top, but I don't think anyone's very sad to see Fatal Fields go.
Okay, so that's the new one, so Lazy Lynx as well.
Cool. Yeah, but they've put like racetracks and all sorts of stuff in.
Bloody hell.
I know, all big right. one.
Go mad for it. Well, it still continues to be big. This is no news to anybody, so you can grab all that stuff right now, both on Switch and on iOS, getting dual updates at the same time. Pretty sweet. Staying apace with the other platforms. Good to see. So, the Harry Potter Hogwarts mystery continues to be a thing, as far as I'm prepared to go with it. And they've started to do real-time events. So, you've got Dueling Club, which is something that has appeared. And... the way that it works is you compete against other players. You have to raise your wand to strike your opponent first. It runs through until July the 15th, so you've got until the end of this weekend as you're listening to it. And all Facebook players will be able to play against folks from around the world, which is nice. I don't think that they addressed that stuff that we disliked the first time out. There wasn't a big update that stopped it being incredibly mean and cynical, was there, that I missed?
I don't think so. Not that I've seen. I think they just kind of, you know, they're big enough to just shrug.
Yeah.
And be like, yeah, but people are still playing it.
Oh, well, never mind. On to nicer news, brighter news. Let's say the App Store has been around for a decade now, which makes me feel incredibly old. I didn't realise it had been 10 years, but then... I did a bunch of videos for the Pocket Gamer 10th anniversary, actually, and we started the company way before I got here, back in the Java days. So we were covering proper early feature phone stuff. And it was frankly adorable. And then 2008 was when the App Store first appeared, and things started getting real. And so what we've done to celebrate this over on Pocket Gamer is, and I say we, I mean John Monday and everyone else other than me, is do a load of articles covering some of the best stuff, the worst stuff, and the interesting things that you might have forgotten about games and apps that appeared on the App Store. Because, you know, there's a lot of stuff that you can't get anymore because of the constant updates of the OS, and even recently when everything jumped to 64-bit, a load of games from 2 years ago won't run, let alone games from 10 years ago. So it's very difficult to find anything that existed at the beginning of the App Store that still runs now. In fact, that should be a thing. We should go looking for a game that was, like, birthed in the first year and still runs now. There must be one that someone's kept updating slavishly for a decade.
Can you imagine the pedigree on that?
I'd be impressed. It would be a superb effort. And probably a massive waste of time. But fair play to them. So, for example, we've got here the games that scored 10 out of 10 over the past 10 years on PG. There aren't many. We are notoriously not stingy, but we're quite, you know, we curate our reviews pretty carefully. And we don't just dish out top scores willy-nilly. We're not that kind of site. So games that got a 10 out of 10 are few and far between. But we've got enough to fill a 10 list. And this is the one that takes me right back. Rolando. That was kind of the first big iPhone game. Back in 2008. And you're playing this little ball that has to roll around. It's a platformer, colourful looking thing. Sort of halfway between Katamari and Loco Roco, I guess. But it was a genuinely good, clever little physics puzzler thing. And it's the one that everybody latched onto and went, hello, this is a sort of proper game, inverted commas, that works on a touchscreen. And people started to go, oh, maybe this iPhone touchscreen gaming thing might catch on. And turns out they were not wrong. So we've got a whole list of other ones, including things like your Zenbound, the original Zenbound. Zenbound 2 just came out for Switch, didn't it?
Yeah, about a month or so ago.
Yeah, that thing's still going strong. And a whole bunch of others, like, go and look at the list, check it out. We've also got some of the weird stuff and the stuff that was frankly the worst for the past decade. But go and have a look at it all, and we're going to send you on this mission. If you can find an app that was launched in 2008, and I'm going to say game, because I think there are some apps that still work, or, you know, they've updated versions of them. Find a game that was released in 2008 and still works in 2018. That is your challenge, listeners. Go out, find it, get back to us. We are back here at the Big Indie Fest in Vienna 2018. I am joined by Troy Horton from Team 17. Welcome.
Welcome.
glad to be here. Well, we thought we want to get a kind of a publisher opinion on all this. I've been talking to lots of developers and about the things that they're looking for in terms of feedback or exposure or whatever, but sometimes they're looking for you guys.
Right, exactly.
So as a publisher, you're wandering around. There are loads of tables here and everyone's got their wares on display. What is it that draws you to a game when you're just wandering around a room?
Well, you know, I mean, there are the obvious attractions. One is the visual part. Obviously, you've got a lot of people walking around. You know, is it attracting a crowd? You know, are other people interested in looking at the title when they're walking past? So, you know, that's one of the things. But, you know, on the other hand, Team 17 is a company. We're interested in certain kinds of titles. So, you know, when you walk past, see a screen, you kind of have a general idea if it would fit within our portfolio or not. Okay. So that's, you know.
So is it on average, the aesthetic, the gameplay?
Or? Right. Well, you know, it's gameplay, it's aesthetic. It doesn't have to be the most beautiful game, but, you know, if it's fun, interesting. I think, you know, for publishers in particular, having a lot of depth is very important. You see a lot of indie games, you know, they're actually quite short, but, you know, that's for a number of reasons. A lack of resources, a lack of funding. Maybe they're new to the industry. They don't really know what makes a comprehensive game that a publisher would be interested in. So, but, you know, this is one of the reasons why we come. It's not just to look for titles, it's to give advice, to help a lot of these budding studios, you know, even single guys here making a game by themselves, right? You know, we can provide advice to them, you know, keep in touch with them. What's not interesting for us today from that guy might be interesting for us next month. You know, he might have made that kind of progress that, you know, we might like to see.
Have you seen a shift over the past, like, say, like 10 or so years? Because it's become much more accessible now. Things like Game Maker means everyone can be an indie in their bedroom, and
right.
one-man teams doing everything. Do you think there's been a shift in terms of the styles that people are going for? The pixel art thing is still going
right.
at this point, but has there been a little new wave you've noticed, or a trend that has appeared?
Not necessarily, but I mean, you're obviously seeing a rise in quality of indie titles right now. But obviously with that comes bigger budgets, bigger teams. You know, they're almost approaching AAA level, but they're not. But then again, if you look at, you know, some of the trends that were popular, that still are popular today, like the pixel, roguelike, you know, platform combat games, whatever,
yeah.
there are gold standards in the market that if you want to make something like that as a single man team or two, three, four people,
mm-hmm.
they're the standards you have to hit. You know, and, you know, those standards, they're selling a million copies.
We mentioned art styles like pixel art and yeah. genres like roguelikes, especially yeah. with indie games. A lot of that's like a practicality thing, isn't it? The idea that
it
if it's a small team, right. you don't have the time to build 50 levels, so getting a, right. a code to do it for you.
Right.
When you are limited to some degree by stuff like that, when you're yeah. a small team, is it rarer to see certain types of game? Like, if one person is creating an entire world landscape, I mean, people talk about Cave Story, and it's one guy, and it took him 5 years
right.
by himself doing the entire thing.
Right.
So is there certain trends that you notice in the types of indie games you see?
Well, you know, everything is based on a developer's resources, and they can only create what they're able to do, right, in the time frame that they can put into it, or they can afford to keep doing it.
Yeah.
But also what skill sets they have. You know, obviously a small indie team being able to afford a very high quality 3D artist who's super animation, you know, might be beyond their realms. So there's not really a trend per se, but it's really more of them just focusing on their skill sets. And that's why you still see a lot of voxel art games, pixel style games, yeah. story driven point and click adventure games, because they're simple to make. There's no AI per se, you know. It's point, you know, narrative, point narrative. And from a resource standpoint, you know, these games are much easier to make, and you can make them much more quickly.
Without having to name any studios or people,
right.
what's one of the biggest common mistakes you see when people go to launch a game? Because I've been talking to people the past few days, and when I come to the part of like, right, so when's your game going to go gold? When are you ready to go live?
Right.
And what's the plan? Like, what's the PR moves you're going to put in place? What websites have you set up? Have you got the Discord server there and everything?
Right, right.
And they kind of go,
Well, that's it. You know, if you look at Steam, 100 plus more games a day,
yeah.
right? You know, and, you know, the key thing, obviously, being able to make a game is an achievement in itself, right? But, you know, discoverability is the next big problem that developers have. And that's where the publisher comes in. You know, Team 17, for example, we've been going almost 30 years. And, you know, we've got a large community of fans that really love our product, previous products, new products. And we're able to access that. So games we sign up, we're able to make them discoverable. Be able to put them on the social media channels where influencers can pick them up and, you know, talk about them,
yeah.
you know, which is critical now. You know, the social media influencer, I mean, it's just, you know, indie developers just cannot get that without a huge piece of luck.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, what publishers bring to the table. So
I think, especially in indie, I hear a lot of suspicion of publishers. I mean, do you hear this stuff back where there's this idea that, like, you've got to be careful about using publishers, they're going to take all your rights and all of your money?
Well, we do hear that, and that's mainly from developers who've had bad experiences themselves. But it's not always the case. You know, there are successful games in the market published by, obviously sold by publishers from indie developers. Team 17 is a great example where we predominantly publish only indie title games, and we're very successful doing it. And to my knowledge, none of them have had a bad experience working with our company. So it really is just about those previous experiences. Team 17, we never take developers' IP. Never. It's never a request of ours. We never put it in any of our contracts. We prefer that developers can build a self-sustainable business model for themselves, and a lot of that revolves around the IP that they're creating. So we're happy for them to keep it every time. Every time.
Okay.
So that means they get the opportunity to make a second one. But if they get the opportunity to make a second one because the first one is a success, they're going to come back to us.
Gotcha.
Right? So, you know, it goes both ways. So, you know, you have to trust the developer, and the developer has to trust the publisher. And one of those ways is letting them keep the IP.
And you guys have been in the industry for, I mean, a long time, since I'm old enough to remember playing Alien Breed on, you know, the Amiga. Like, that was...
Everyone says Worms, but
that was my
you're the second person who said Alien Breed.
I moved down to Bournemouth, and I knew Andy, who made Worms. He had a Commodore shop called Caltech that was down the road from me. So we used to hang out, and I saw the early build, and it was called Total Wormage. And then I imagine that was a conversation at the Hitch Point. We can't call it that, because terrible things will happen when we release it. But like you say, you've been able to sustain the business for a long time. And what do you feel has been the key? Is it just we've picked the right games, or we've adapted to the different types of trends in the industry? I mean, free-to-play is going mad and is becoming the default now, and has been for about like 3-4 years. Like, well, is it moving with the time?
I have my own take on free-to-play, but in terms of Team 17, it's, you know, we have a good due diligence process where, you know, we've more often than not backed the right horse, so to speak. You know, we do our research on the product that we're interested in signing. You know, would it fit in our portfolio? Where does it sit in the market? You know, what is the risk profile, the investment profile? What's the return of investment? You know, we do research on understanding whether the developer is capable of delivering what they say they want to deliver. And that's a very key, important part of the process, you know. So, you know, we go through this process every time with every game we sign. And that allows us to, you know, back, you know, the better indie games in the market. And, you know, coming to places like this, you know, we do get the opportunity to see one or two standout games that we think potentially will work on the Team 17 label.
And if people are watching this, because they will be, this is going out on the kind of the, all of the sites and the biz sites as well. So if developers are watching this right now and thinking, I want to grab the attention of a publisher or maybe specifically Team 17, what should they do? What's the thing they should be doing?
Right. Well, the most important thing is, like, you know, any game publisher, we need to see a build of the game. We've got to be able to touch it, feel it, experience it. You know, Team 17, don't forget, we're developers ourselves. We're not just a straight publisher, right? So, you know, we understand that when we get builds from developers, they're not finished. Maybe they have placeholder graphics. Some of the functions don't exist yet. I've got a lot of placeholder things in there. That's fine. We understand. But, you know, from a general vision of a developer, they should at least have some of that in the build that they send to us. And from that, you know, we can take it to the next step if we're interested. And we know that a lot of these developers need support as well. And this is another thing with Team 17 being developers. We have 150-plus development staff, like an army of developers, who can do some of the heavy lifting if that indie needs help to deliver across multiple platforms so they can focus on the lead platform, on the game, on the vision, right? So it's really the build. Building a pitch. I don't need, you know, we don't need a 200-page game design document, a 300-page technical design document. You know, we need a short PPT. What is the game? What's its unique features? If you need funding, how much? What's it for? Build. This is really it for us for the first step to move it to the second step.
It's the same with the big indie pitch event that we do here. Every people, you've got 3-4 minutes to show the game, and they pull out sort of their PowerPoint presentation, and then it's over, and it's like, just give me the game, play the game, and
well,
then
typically you can know within 5 minutes if it's a game we would be interested in. I mean, obviously, you know, there's much more to a game than just looking at it for 5 minutes. You know, there's a certain depth you might not get after an hour into the gameplay, but that pitch, they've got to try and get this message across that there is much more to it than this 3-4 minutes you're seeing right now, and that's the challenge they face. But, you know, Team 17, we accept submissions via our website. So things we don't see here today, you know, they can easily submit, you know, online.
There you go. Go and do that if you're interested. Thank you for talking to me today, Troy. Appreciate it.
and about this week. We have got a ton of iOS games, but we're going to start out with a Switch game that came out today. I think, Rick, you've been playing Octopath Traveler.
Yes.
I have no idea what this is.
It is. How to describe it? It's a hardcore JRPG that's not really a hardcore JRPG. So it's made by Square Enix and Acquire, who did the Bravely Default and Bravely Second games.
Yep,
3DS. I know those. So it's this cross between a 3D world that you run around, but all the characters in it are 16-bit styled sprites.
Okay.
So it's got this really weird and interesting art style. And the idea is that you have 8 characters, hence the Octopath. Uh-huh. And you can pick which ones you pick and like take into your party and stuff. You can have 4 in your party at any one time. And you don't even have to find any of the characters if you don't want to. So if you're just not interested in someone based on their name, then you don't have to go and start their quest. You just ignore them completely. Mm-hmm. And you run about the world, and each character has their own story that you sort of follow through. There's no grand story, there's no huge world-ending event that you have to worry about. There's just the stories of the characters that you're picking up as you go along, which is kind of interesting. It's very small scale, but on a larger world, I guess.
I'm looking at it now, and it looks lovely. The colour wash, it's done in this almost like sepia-toned like colour wash, and seeing the 2D sprites running around on a 3D plane is actually really nice.
Mm. Yeah, it's not very flashy. There's no, like, there's not huge amounts of big animations and stuff, even in battles and stuff. But sort of the lighting and the effects and the particles and that kind of thing are really good, and just it sort of pops in a way, I guess. The 8 characters thing should work. It sounds like a good idea, but in practice it becomes kind of a bit crap, because particularly at the start, you pick one character and you go, okay, that's great, I'm going to pick up another character now. But when you pick up that character, they're level 1, so you've got to start all over again with them.
Oh, right.
And by the end of it, you've got a squad of people who are all like level 15, and then you have to go pick up a level 1 character, and the quests scale up with you, so that character is now awful, but you need to keep them in your party because it's their story.
Right.
And then when you finish that, you go, okay, now I guess I'll go do some chapter 2s now. But the chapter 2s are all way higher level than what you've got in your party. So you have to go out and do some grinding before you can carry on the story. And the stories themselves aren't actually that interesting.
Yeah.
It's mostly just 8 different JRPG tropes kind of thrown into one thing.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of doesn't work. What does work is the combat, which is absolutely astounding and possibly the best JRPG system there's been in a long time.
Oh, bold. So I'm looking at it now, and it looks like the classic, you know, line up against each other, active time battle type stuff. Is it not that, or is it?
So it's turn-based, and you have sort of a... You can see which turn is coming next and that kind of thing, so you can plan ahead.
Yep.
And you take turns to attack, and you can use skills, and you can defend, or you can run away, and you can use items, and that kind of thing. But the twist is, so it's kind of like the Persona series, where your opponents will have a certain weakness, and hit them with that weakness, and they'll go down.
Mm.
But they have sort of a guard gauge sort of thing, and so you have to chip away at that first. So if they've got 3 on their guard gauge, you need to hit them 3 times with something they're weak against before they'll go down. And then they go out for a turn, you can do huge amounts of damage to them because all their weaknesses are gone, and then they get back up again. And once they get up, their turn goes to the front of the queue, and they will attack you every time. You can't avoid being attacked by them. So it stops you from sort of stun-locking them and making the game really easy for yourself.
Yeah.
So every single fight that you go into is always sort of fraught with danger, because you could just get wiped out in one move, even though you seem to be doing really well. So that's quite interesting. And then it's also got this boost point system, so you have these little points that you gain once per turn, and then once you've got enough, you can sort of add them onto your attacks by hitting a button and power up your moves. So you can hit them with huge amounts of elemental damage if you level that up, and you can also hit enemies multiple times in one move. So if, as I say in the previous example, if they've got 3 on their guard gauge, you can hit them 3 times in one round with your weapon. And so you can take out an entire enemy squad and just have them all downed at one go. So there's huge amounts of tactics. It's really easy to pick up and play, and it's really clever in the way it does the combat. The combat is so good that even though you're grinding a lot, you won't mind it so much.
Mm-hmm.
The story's not great, but you just kind of power through because the game itself just plays beautifully. And there's a whole other side of it that I'm not even talking about. There's a scene where you go into a library and you can just challenge the librarian to a fight, and she's well up for it. and then once you beat them, they just lie on the floor unconscious.
Every time I've challenged my librarian to a fight, they've wimped out. So,
but she's like, no, I'm fine with this, but can we keep it down? This is a library.
Quiet fight.
You smack the crap out of her, and then your character goes, "That was a good fight. Thank you very much." And she's just unconscious on the floor, and you can no longer speak to her. You have to leave the entire town before she'll come back to life.
Because you battered their librarian.
Yeah.
Run
but
out
you could just go around
village.
An entire town and batter everybody for no wow. other reason than because you can. It's just, okay. Yeah, it's very silly and it's very fun, and I would highly recommend it if you like RPGs and don't mind some limp story.
Right, fine. That's sort of the opposite of what I want, really, from an RPG. I want the good story, and often the combat falls into second place a little bit, but I do like that art style. It does look pretty. So you can buy this as a boxed game as well, can't you? I think.
Yes.
I think this is a real one rather than just a
proper full
e-shop.
Release.
Proper full release. So Octopath Traveler, that is out on Switch right now. I'm going to mention what is the biggest game from the past fortnight from Harry's point of view, certainly, our reviewer Harry, because he's got a new star, Soccer Manager Mental. So I did the review for this on App Spy, and because obviously he's been playing the game, and this is how we do the reviews on App Spy, where I'll you know play the game, capture video for it, and it'll often be based on text that maybe someone else has written. And never has there been more of a disparity between our places within the game, our level. Because I've captured footage and I've been playing for like a couple of hours. So my guy's like level 5, level 6, level 7. And then I got Harry to send me some pictures of his stats. And he was just like, level 95. Yeah. And I had £350 in the bank and he had 2.7 million. He's played this game a lot. He's played this game for about 70-something hours.
Yeah, I think it was 79 hours in the end.
Yeah, so he's completed it and done everything there can be done, and he's in love with it, and it's got a platinum award. As I mentioned earlier, this is the sequel to New Star Soccer, which was that kind of surprise soccer gaming hit from like a very small developer, independent guy who made this weird game, which was a mixture of strategy. You were following one player's path throughout the tournament, and his career going up through the echelons of Premiership football. And there wasn't much actual football involved. The games would take place like a football manager game where you'd see text of, oh, and he's passed, oh, and he's missed, and then time would just tick up. But then occasionally it would freeze and you'd see the pitch and you'd get to do like a shot or a pass or something, and then it would carry on. This game, you're controlling the entire team and you're controlling every aspect of that, from signing sponsors to give you cash when you take their stuff out on the pitch, to dealing with the managers, to dealing with the board members, to working with each individual player and making sure they're progressing and okay. And then when the games take place, it still does that text scroll stuff, but then you get to build play using all the team members. So you'll be able to actually set up, like, pass to him, pass by tapping on individual characters, pass to him, pass to you, and then pull back and you can run for a little bit and then pull back and release and do a shot. So you'll actually get to play a bit of football, which feels a bit more like Sabutio this time because you're controlling loads of different players. And then you're back to the management side of it and working your way through. It's a lot slicker than New Star Soccer. You can see that game made a lot of money and they've done a whole bunch of spin-offs since. So this is sort of the true sequel. Even I, who don't like football, I don't care about football, can see how it's compulsive. Spending a couple of hours with it, I was like, actually, I think I'm enjoying myself, which I didn't expect to be, because it's not my jam. But read Harry's review, or watch the App Spy video, because it's 10 out of 10, one of the few platinums we've ever given out. And he's mad for it, thinks it's amazing. I'm not sure it's going to be as big a hit as the first one. I don't know whether management stuff puts a lot of people off. You just want to play football. But I think if you like this, slow text-based pace of the original, you've got to like this, surely, I think. So New Star Soccer Manager, that's out right now if you want to have a look. A couple of things from last week that we missed. So there's a new rally game out called Best Rally, which looks a little bit better than, I think, Real Rally was the one that I reviewed before I went, which was kind of not good. This looks more of a traditional sort of isometric Micro Machines style racer. So you can get that right now. It's free to play. The one I have played a bunch of is Dead Island Survivors. So that game that was sort of quasi-controversial back on the previous generation, mainly because of its slightly dodgy PR involving decapitated female torsos being sent to outlets. Remember that?
I try to forget that so much.
The headless headless and limbless bikini. Basically, they just sent a pair of bloody tits to gaming outlets, and because like we're so edgy, you're like, are you really? Because that first Dead Island game, it's not very good. Sorry, it's a bit rubbish. But I think it did very well. And then there was a sequel, and then we've been waiting for one on this generation. But Dead Island Survivors is not a first-person zombie smasher. It is kind of a tower defense game set on a series of islands, and it's got a bit of Kingdom Rush in it, insofar as you've got a hero character which you control, but also you're setting up defenses as these zombies come stomping down the way towards an electrified fence behind which are the survivors. It puts more focus on the hero character because you can actually run around and do quite heavy attacks and stuff like that. You control it like it's a standard like twin stick shooter, but you're also dealing with that tower defense aspect, and it's actually quite good. It's got loads of polish, and the combat actually feels quite chunky when you're battering people with a big hammer. You get the impact, and you're like, nice. And then the tower defense aspect has some interactive aspects to it. So instead of just setting up towers and then standing back and watching them blow things up, there are traps and stuff that are around, scattered around the level that you can trigger in real time. So zombies will walk out across this bridge, and there's this kind of water system. If you tap the water system, it'll like burst a spray of water that'll push them off the bridge and into the water and drown them. But you have to activate it by actually tapping it in real time. So there's a bit more engagement in, you know, the second-to-second action beyond just watching your towers obliterate everybody. It's still free to play, and it looks a little bit grindy from where I played. I could see myself getting cut off quite quick. But it's not bad. Pretty good. Dead Island Survivors is the name of that one. Might be worth a look.
Kind of have to hope it would be pretty good, because they spent like 2 years in soft launch on that game, I think.
I didn't know it. I wasn't even aware of it. I wasn't aware it was a thing. It completely crept up on me. But yeah, that's out right now for free if you want. We've got Earth Atlantis, which I'm about to do the review for, and I've played some of, you know, in preparation for it. This is cool. Certainly, visually, it's very, very striking. So I don't know if you've seen any videos of this, guys, but it's kind of taking the monochromatic Game Boy styling, although instead of everything being green and black, it's kind of that sepia tone again, a dusty brown and black, but the visuals are very 3D. It's like a wireframe where everything is transparent, everything's just the outlines and the details, but you can sort of see through it. But it's fully 3D, and there's loads of stuff going on in the foreground and background, and you take control of a submarine that is floating around a series of tunnels side on, like a shmup, sort of side scroller. But rather than it being a straight up shmup, it feels more like a Metroidvania. Because you've got a kind of large overworld map in the top corner of the screen, and you've got a series of objectives you have to hit. And so you're often going through all these tunnels, finding an objective, which is usually a big squid monster or giant octopus, and blowing the crap out of him. And then you have to double back on yourself and go back to another area, which is now available. So it's got that constantly going back on yourself, exploring a world, and then revisiting areas which have now been augmented or changed since last you visited. You can flip your ship 180, so you can scroll forward and then tap the right side of the screen, and you'll just flip, and then you'll be scrolling left to right instead of right to left. You're always firing, and the creatures that come up to you are, you know, all aqua themed naturally, but it's got that steampunky aesthetic that Jules Verne 10,000 leagues 20,000 leagues whatever it is, some leagues under the sea. And I'm quite taken with the presentation, taken with the art style, and I like the fact that I'm having to, you know, think. That map placement stuff is good. I enjoy the Metroidvania, have to go back, find your way back to where you came from stuff. I like that, it's good. He's really liked it, Harry. 9 out of 10 for that. I'm going to play more of it a little bit later and hope it stands up. Em, you were playing something over the past fortnight as well. What was it?
Yeah, I was playing Up Left Out. Which it came out, I want to say, about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, 2-3 weeks. We haven't covered it.
No, well, I literally only got around to playing it last weekend. And of course, the chap who makes the games, his company's called Rainbow Train. Mm-hmm. I mean, his stuff is always just so good and so minimal.
He's a dude who did Clocky, right?
Yeah. All very clean, all kind of the same design. And in this one, you have to slide tiles around. Do you remember those games you used to get in, like, the 90s? You get them from Christmas crackers and stuff, where you had one space on a tile board.
Yes, yes.
And you've got to, like, try and, you know, fiddle all the bits around to make the picture or something.
Fiddle the bits.
Yep. Fiddle the bits. And in this one, you just kind of have to unlock each tile, because it's got a peg which tells you which way the tile can move, so side to side or up and down or round a corner or something.
Yeah.
And it starts off like really simple like that, where you just kind of have to unlock it. It's all good. Eventually, as you go throughout the game, it brings in more mechanics, but at like the perfect time.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll go from just having to, you know, move it left or right or up and down. And you'll have to start switching buttons to open walls so you can move tiles around, and like flipping buttons so you can flip tiles over.
I'm playing it right now. It's elegant as hell.
It's really elegant.
This guy's really good at this stuff. What he does very well, I feel, is all puzzle games, or most of them, are based around some kind of interaction or movement. He makes the movements feel nice. As you said, the block's got a peg in the middle of it, and then there is a line going from the center outwards, and it shows you you need to pull it off the peg, but you can only slide it one way. When you pull it off, the peg vanishes and the block like locks into place. That feels nice.
Mm. Yeah, and it's like eventually you'll be unlocking blocks which will then have lines that run through them, and then you've got to try and complete the pattern.
Oh, okay.
Like a bit further down the line. And that's where like a challenge starts coming in, because things do genuinely get really difficult, but it's that sort of difficulty that's not impossible to get around, and you can either figure out the thingy by like turning your device a different way or coming back to it in like 5 minutes, and usually you'll be able to figure it out. And when you do, it's like the most satisfying feeling.
This looks good. I like this.
Yeah, no, it's like I'm still playing it, because it's so like a lot of people will probably play it and be like, oh, you know, it's really repetitive and it's really, you know, there's not really much to it and things. And it's like, yeah, but that's kind of his jam, if you know what I mean. He knows what he wants, and he knows how his game should play, and he does them well.
Hmm. Balls down on a single idea and then exploits it really well, I think.
Exactly.
Excellent. So, Up, Left, Out is the name of that one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, do have a look at that, and then check out the guy's history. If you look in the apps also produced by bit on the App Store, all the stuff is pretty much gold. Like, Clocky particularly is really, really good, so go have a look at that. I was playing Fighting Fantasy Legends Portal on the stream. We've been doing streams, by the way, digital board games. We've been working with Asmodee to sort of go, hey, we like digital board games and we don't think enough people are playing them, because I understand, and I'm guilty of this as well, when, you know, sometimes board games get a bit of like but I'm not six, and it's a bit boring, I've got to set it all up, and this isn't very exciting, and I've got a gun, what's the point? No, all of that's wrong. Board games are brilliant and continue to be brilliant, and the digital versions of board games are often brilliant as well, and we think you should be playing them. So, we've been playing a bunch of them on the Asmodee Digital stream, which I would invite you to come and see, because we're doing it every Tuesday at 5 p.m. in the UK. We're just starting it, and it's going to be a lark. This week's was Fighting Fantasy Legends Portal, which is a sequel to Fighting Fantasy Legends, which came out last year sometime. I think I interviewed... I forget whether I interviewed Ian Livingston or Steve Jackson, one of them, about it. And it is pretty much the same game, but dealing with new books. So these are based on the 80s fighting fantasy books that they wrote back in the day. And this one covers three books. It plays in exactly the same way the first game did, which means that it's very much a choice and dice-based system. So you'll be wandering around a map, you'll be asked to come to a crossroads, and it'll do the description and say, do you want to go left, or do you want to go right, or do you want to talk to this guy, or do you want to go to this shop, or whatever it is. Make your choice. Do you want to open box A, open box B, open this door, walk straight past? What do you think? And then you choose your choice. And then if you hit combat, you've got a bunch of red skill dice at the top of the screen, which is probably the most satisfying part of all the mechanics, really. Because when I say it's dice-based, I don't mean like there's a dice at the top of the screen, you hit it and it randomly spins on the spot. It's got eight dice, and then when you hit it, all the dice roll all over the screen as if you rolled them with real dice physics, making real dice noises, and you get that, oh, is it going to jip? And it, or sometimes it gets stuck on the side and then it falls over. And that's what I love about those dice-based games. Like, the actual roll of the dice is one of these, like, it's one of the peaks of excitement in it, because that's where chance comes in and anything could happen. And replicating that feel in a game where really what's happening is there's a number generator going on behind the scenes. That's what it is. But usually that stuff is hidden. I like it when they put the dice on the screen and let you see it. It doesn't make it any more or less fair, but it just makes me feel like I'm witnessing the thing play out, and it feels more, you know, connected to the classic board game feel that these games are trying to reproduce. So that stuff's really fun. And there's a luck-based dice system as well, if you need to, like, activate a trap or, you know, jump over a big chasm in the floor or something like that. The books themselves are wandering around dungeons. The first one is dungeon exploration, and then I think it expands to the overworld in the other two books, but I haven't played that yet. It's an obvious thing to say. If you like the first one, you'll like this. But you will, because it's exactly the same mechanic, exactly the same game, just new content, really. But it's a standalone thing. You can go and grab it independently if you want to. We liked it. It does everything it does right. 8 out of 10 for that. So you can go and get that if you fancy. Something that you turned me on to, Fracture, just came out. We saw this spooky trailer thing where it's all monochrome with this... what looks like a lassie running around with this orb above her head, and then there are people, and then they get all down on all fours and kind of crab scuttle over to you, and then the trailer ended and we were like, ugh, looks creepy. And it is kind of creepy. So I've played a bunch of this now. It's an isometric puzzler, platform puzzler kind of thing. You're only on one level really, but there are some stairs that take you up to other areas. And the idea is you've been cast into this strange world. There's a hub in the middle with a bunch of doors, and you go through them one by one. And then they take you down pathways, and you have to solve puzzles involving light, aiming light beams at objects so that they activate and you'll open a door to get to the next section. But quite quickly you encounter enemies, and you have to walk very slowly and stay out of their eyesight in order to get past them. So it's controlled by how hard you move the virtual analog. So, you know, if you just move a little bit, you just creep around. If they see you, they kind of go scuttle over to you, and it's instant death. Like, you're just done for. So that's the survival horror bit of it. It's not very horrific, to be honest. It's a little bit spooky with those creatures, but it's not scary. I really like the presentation and the mood and the tone that they're going for. I think it struggles a bit with the isometric view because... there are some staircases you can't quite see where they begin because the camera's in that fixed place. So the level design doesn't necessarily always complement the camera position, I don't think. And with the whole necessity for sneaky, sneaky, stalky, stalky, extremely precise analog control, I'm not 100% that like touchscreen floating joysticks is the best format for this kind of gameplay. Because virtual sticks are, you know, if you want extreme 100% precision, virtual joysticks are not the things that deliver that, really. I can play it, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't feel like this is the perfect game for mobile. You see what I mean?
Yeah. It's always difficult at isometric view anyway with floating joysticks.
Because it's about working out where you are, and it can be quite difficult to judge whether you're about to walk up the stairs or walk off the cliff. If you're going into the lower left-hand side of the screen and there's a bunch of geometry in the way and you can't really see, you know, which bit your character's walking towards. So there's that going on. I don't think it's bad, and I've only played like about half an hour, three quarters of an hour, so there's more to go. We haven't reviewed it yet. It's £3.99, $3.99, and out right now on both iOS and Android. Fracture is the name of that. Definitely worth a look. It's curious. Stuff we haven't played, Battleheart 2 we haven't played yet. That's only just come out, so we're going to jump on a code for that one. And that sequel to Mika Mobile's game from, God, how long ago was the original Battleheart? Like, so long ago. I'm thinking 2011?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's been a fair few years.
Yeah, a hell of a long time before they've done an official sequel to this. Apparently it's jumped straight up the charts. There were some people who were very, very fond of the original, which was kind of a big old fancy action RPG battler. It was fun. We really liked the original. We'll have to see how this one plays after 7 years of... I assume it hasn't been in development for 7 years. But, you know, it's taken a while to see the light of day. But you can get that right now. That's also £3.99, $3.99. And the other thing I mentioned that I don't think any of us have played is The Walking Dead has got an AR game now called The Walking Dead Our World, which is Pokemon Go with zombies.
Yay.
Jurassic Park did one, and Ghostbusters did one, or will be doing one, and this is the Walking Dead one. So you go to a place, you get set missions, you have to go and rescue some people. When you turn up at the area, you hold your phone up, and there'll be a person there, and there'll be a whole bunch of zombies milling about, and then you have to actually shoot them. It goes like first-person shooter, from the trailer anyway, and you go bang, 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 shoot up all the zombies, and then you did a mission. Well done, you. We'll have to play it. I haven't had a go yet, but...
is that solemn what? Resignation. Oh, we'll have to play it.
Okay, yes.
I'm contractually obliged to play this game.
It's literally my job. I'm not a Walking Dead fan, so it, you know, this doesn't have the same buzz for me as something, you know. Pokemon Go was interesting because people were like, I love Pokemon and I like going places, whereas, you know, I don't really care for The Walking Dead, so shrug. And zombies bore the tits off me at this point, so, you know. But I'm sure it could be really good, right?
Yeah, good. Sure. I mean, to be fair, I have downloaded it on my phone. I do intend to go and have a go with it this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I'll be ambling off into town. May as well scare some people, you know, walking around me if a zombie comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, they'd be like, what the hell was wrong with that girl?
Tell like, the baker that there's a zombie behind her. Yeah. Jesus Christ, hide the buns.
But so I will report back to you on Monday if it is any good.
Good stuff. All right, then. I think that's our due diligence. Long one this week, probably about an hour in total. Goodness me. But that's our fault for abandoning you. So there's your bumper edition of the PG podcast. We'll be back next week. Won't be scampering off for a while. I think September is the next definite scheduled thing when we're going to go to PG Connects in Helsinki. But until then, normal service should be resumed. So thank you for waiting. And hopefully you guys will tune in next week and join us for more PG podcasting. Thank you for listening. We will see you next time.
Bye.
We love you. Bye.